Welcome to Doctor's Orders with your host, Dr. Baker. Now let's join today's program.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Doctor's Orders. It is Trending Thursday. We're really excited to have our guest today that I will introduce in a moment, Ms. Dr. Maria Espinola. But as we've been talking, we know that our goal and the work is to help businesses that are 50 million in scope and under, 500 employees or less. We want to help your businesses get better. We want to help your businesses get better in many ways. And one of those ways is understanding just different elements, different actions that you can take yourself on a daily basis as a business owner to make your business better. If you want to join the conversation, if your business needs help, don't forget, you can join by calling us at 859-291-2255. Once again, that's 859-291-2255. So today on Trending Thursdays, we're going to look inside of the office, how you work as even a leader or a member of an organization, a member of a company, and how to think about your work, how to think about your interaction with others, how to think about even yourself inside of the workplace. You know, as a micro boutique mom and pop or just business owner, you have a lot of things to contend with. You wear a lot of hats in many cases. Sometimes your departments are either underdeveloped or maybe you don't even have other departments. And in that instance, you have to be smart about how you operate. We've talked about it previously as to growing your business. You need to have experts that will assist you in different ways. So once again, if there's legal matters, you need to have a good lawyer that you have on retainer. If they are for your finances, you need to have a financial strategist or an accountant to help you assist with the goals, the financial goals overall of the company, along with the structure of the company. Well, there's other services that may be needed as a business owner. And we're talking in this instance, everything from small or micro boutique businesses all the way to large corporations. We want to make sure that your business is as healthy as possible. And so in today's episode, as I go ahead and I bring Dr. Maria on, we're going to share how you should look at your business in a healthy way to where you can make good decisions, that your employees can be happy around them, that you can receive the right type of job satisfaction that you're looking for. So without further ado, I bring along Dr. Maria Espinola. How are you doing today, Doctor?
Great. Thank you for having me, Dr. Baker.
Fantastic. Glad you could join us. And for the audience and all the listeners, please tell the folks out there what it is that you do, what you specialize in.
Yeah, of course. So I'm a clinical psychologist by training with expertise in multicultural issues and trauma. And I founded the Institute for Health Equity and Innovation, which is an organization dedicated to reducing healthcare disparities through data-driven approaches. And we use technology and the latest research to help organizations identify which problems to prioritize and how to best target them. And one example of that is a problem that is certainly trending now, and that is stress and burnout. And this is impacting everybody, no matter who you are, because whether you're experiencing it personally or your employees are or business partners or family members, stress burnout can affect you and your business in ways that people don't usually think about.
Fantastic. Let's talk about that a little bit. You know, I want to focus in on two things that you mentioned, stress and burnout. And people have experienced stress and burnout well before today's climate. I know that mental health is something that has been trending within our society because we've been paying a little bit more attention to it. And I want to be careful when I say it a little bit because I believe we could do a better job. But I would also add in some of the realities of COVID and what that's done. So if we can just take a moment, let's talk about just kind of the impact of stress and burnout in the workplace. What have you seen based on your experiences and how should we look at that?
Oh, yes. I mean, a big one. I mean, mental health impacts you in every possible way because it impacts how you behave, how you think, how you concentrate or not, you know, how you become not able to concentrate on what you're doing. So a big issue is productivity. So research has shown that the more stressed you are, the less productive you become, which leads you to make less money. And the less money you make, the more stressed you are. So the longer you go without addressing it, the worse it becomes. It's like a snowball that can destroy your business. Whether you are a business of one or you are the CEO of a company with 100,000 employees, you should listen to this. You should pay attention to it.
Well, you talk about stress and how it makes you less productive, but how does anyone even recognize that they're stressed there? And let me qualify my question. We know a person is feeling stressful when they acknowledge it. And they go ahead and they say, hey, I'm stressed out, or I might need a vacation, or they start to get frustrated, maybe annoyed easily, or things become bigger problems to them. But I think at that time, it's pretty obvious. Are there other, I would say, symptoms or realities that exist before you even recognize that you're stressed out? Or does it come with loud symptoms that we can all see?
Most often comes, as you say, so it could be like you had an interaction with a client today or a business partner, and it didn't go well. You're pretty upset, aggravated, irritated, and you don't sleep well tonight. And then tomorrow you are even more grumpy because you haven't slept, and then you eat more than usual or eat less because you're too stressed to even eat. And then you get in an argument with your wife, and then you forget to do stuff that needs to get done for the business or at home. And then it's kind of like the problems start accumulating over and over and over. So the longer you go without sleeping, without exercising, without eating well, without taking care of your relationships, the worse things become. So the earlier you can intervene, the better is the outcomes are going to be.
Well, is it a reality where sometimes we still may not recognize it? You might think that, you're just having a bad day, or that just comes along with hard work, but maybe not even looking at it as stress. I know that I talk to different business owners every single day, and oftentimes, you got a scenario where something difficult may arise, and it might actually be a stressful one, or it just might be a part of the operation or a part of the industry where it's a necessary part. Is there a way to differentiate, or is it all considered stress?
Oh, this is a great question. So I think what I like to do, I use personally, and I recommend my clients to do the same, is to measure your stress from 0 to 10. So having a stress at a 0 is actually not helpful. So if you have 0 stress about your business, you're not going to get anything done, right? So you need to have a little bit of a stress just to get interested in it and get motivated. So from 0 to 10, so 0 will be no stress at all. 10 will be the most stress you ever felt. And sometimes it's even more helpful to identify each emotion. So one thing that is good to ask yourself, if you're irritated with someone, you get into an argument, to ask yourself from 0 to 10, where am I in anger? And if the response is 4 or more, stop. So just do not do or say what you're thinking about doing or saying. And if you find yourself getting into like rating this and being at high level, so pretty consistently at a 7, on a daily basis for several weeks, it is important to go and seek some type of intervention. Because like I said, the sooner you get this addressed, the better you're going to be.
I want to ask a question about that, because something just hit me pretty heavy. And in this current climate, we talk about, EQ or emotional quotient, emotional intelligence. Does that have everything to do with your awareness of your own feelings? Is there something that someone can do regularly to kind of test themselves to make sure that they're not slipping into a stressful behavior, a stressful pattern without really knowing that that's where they are? Or is it just simply more about the awareness or having others watch the behavior? What have you seen in your experiences?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. This is something that people miss so consistently, self-awareness. And that is one of the first things that I target in treatment. So it's really helping clients increase their self-awareness, just being very aware of what's going on in terms of their emotions, their behaviors, their thoughts, and then others. So you cannot become aware of others if you're not even, looking at yourself. You have to start with you and then move on to others.
Well, I think it's important as a business owner to already recognize before you go into the business that you're going to have things that I would consider to be stressors and triggers. I'm not clinically trained in this reality, but some of it just makes really good sense. That if we know, let's say you have 5 or 6 meetings in a day, you have to lead every single one of those meetings or appointments, that may become a trigger for stress. And so you have to have a level of awareness that tells you that, well, today I'm going to be in a gauntlet. What are my outlets to help me? What am I going to do to counterbalance that? And then having the awareness before you actually slip into the stressful scenarios. Does that make good sense, Doc?
Oh, 100%. And, you know, one of the reasons why it's so important to increase your own self-awareness before you check others is because it changes our perception of reality. So you might recognize that people hearing it today can recognize moments when they were very, very irritated, and things that didn't bother them on any other day became really bothersome on that specific day because they were grumpy and they were like not willing to take it. And that can happen when you're interacting with employees and coworkers. So you first have to take care of your, you know, increase your self-awareness and then come up with a plan, a prevention plan, to make sure you do not get into these states of mind that are very difficult to manage. So generally, you do want to take breaks consistently throughout the day, and then more extended breaks, you know, at least like once or twice a week. And some people tell me, well, I have no time, I cannot do that. And the reality is that your brain is going to take those breaks regardless, whether you want it or not. So this is going to look different. So you're going to show up for the meeting, like physically, but not mentally.
Well, you know, you mentioned about the physical nature. I've just known this from being, you know, active my entire life, that when your body isn't doing well, physically it will tell you to go sit down. But sometimes our mind, because we're thinking about things and we're controlling some of our thoughts, some of them we aren't, but some of them we're saying, no, I need to push forward, or no, I just need to get this done, or no, if I don't do this, then this other thing will happen. Well, isn't it true that things that happen to you from a stress-related, you know, incident could also have physical ramifications to you as well?
Oh, huge. I mean, that's a really interesting topic that I've been, you know, focusing on for a long time, because I was full-time faculty member at a medical school, so the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Prior to that, I had academic appointments at Boston University School of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. So I've been working with physicians for a while, and I love the approach of integrated medicine, you know, working together, because very consistently, a lot of the issues that patients bring up, for instance, for family medicine, about 80% of the patient's concerns can relate to psychology and emotional issues. So, yes, we have to work together, because physical health and mental health are, you know, they affect one another, and there is no physical health without mental health.
You know, you mentioned a statistic there which actually had me alarmed, and I'm saying it this way for a reason, is that if there's 80% of things that are falling within that psychological realm, if you will, if I'm saying that statistic appropriately, I personally don't hear enough of business owners talking about the psychological measure of their businesses. You know, I met this morning, I had meetings up in Dayton, Ohio, and I met about 30 business owners there, and I left there and went to a manufacturing plant, and I met about 40 individuals there at the manufacturing plant. And inside of these conversations, I had some pretty intimate conversations as they open up to me to tell me about the work that they do. But psychological measures never become a part of the conversation. Even once I'm hired to provide business treatment, that's also not stated. So I'm given a little bit of that background to learn in your experiences. Number one, how easy is it for a business owner, especially someone that's in a position above others, to talk about psychological issues? And does the conversation come up without you extracting it to make sure that they can be healthy in the workplace? Or is that something you have to force? Kind of share with us, what does that look like with your experience?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting topic, because I think organizations are struggling a lot about how to proceed when it comes to this issue. I think, I mean, what I identify like four different problems, problematic behaviors that organizations are engaging in. So I think one is not even assessing the problem. So many organizations don't even use assessment tools to determine how many of their employees are struggling at all. So it's not there. Two, they're attempting to assess the problem, but they are using inadequate assessment tools. So many organizations use questionnaires that are outdated, ineffective, or not backed by science. Three, they accurately assess the problem, but they're not doing anything about it. And I know so many of this. So many organizations do conduct surveys and their employees complete them, but nothing gets done afterwards. So as a psychologist who has seen a lot of frustrated employees, I can tell you this is a very, very common complaint. People very often will come for therapy and say, I am so sick of this company because they have me complete so many surveys and interviews, and I told them exactly what was going on, and nothing was done about it. And it feels really invalidating and frustrating for people. And four is attempting to address a problem using ineffective strategies. So those are, I think, problematic behaviors on the part of the organizations. In terms of what works, I am excited to share that. So I started a partnership with an organization called Org Vitals, and this is an integrated data and predictive intelligence platform that uses groundbreaking research to help organizations accurately identify which problems are their employees having and which areas they should prioritize in order to improve organizational performance. So the platform integrates data that comes from employee experience assessments, so those surveys and questionnaires that people complete, and helps organizations, so uses artificial intelligence to help organizations identify what are some areas of strength. So that could be employee engagement, belonging, for instance, and then identifies areas of opportunity. So that can include training managers on how to provide feedback more effectively, and then stress management programs, for instance, and then also identifies blind spots, which can be communication issues or how connected employees are to one another. And what I love about this is that the research behind comes from co-founder Brad Schack, who is a professor, a world-renowned expert in the areas of engagement, leadership, employee health, and well-being. And very excited to be working with him now as an advisor and using this tool to help my clients identify priorities and help them develop strategies to effectively target burnout, but from every angle, because all the things that I mentioned directly impact burnout rates and mental health.
You know, my specialty and my PhD is in business and leadership, and there's a lot that I do in the realm of leadership. I speak all over the nation regarding matters of leadership. And one thing that's always been unique to me is really the lack of importance that's been placed to psychological measures in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And then how do you deal with that? But when I say the lack of psychological measures, I'm actually talking about from the follower. I got into an argument rant, if you will, over the weekend regarding how a lot of people want to be leaders, but they're really bad followers. And you say, okay, well, what does that then mean? Is that no one ever says, you know, you should really be a good follower. People tell you to go branch out or become the next leader. But the reason why I'm making this statement is that to be a good follower, you have to understand, number one, your makeup, then the makeup of the individuals that you're seeking to follow, how those things match combined with where you are in time and place. So when I say time and place, and I'll just give a couple examples of this. If I know, and I'll just use some basic ones, I'm going into the military. Well, if I go into the military, I have to have the right temperament for one, what I think the military offers, and then two, what the military tells me that it offers. And I need to understand my role and place and time inside of that. If I know that I'm going to be the head of a nonprofit organization and part of my duties are fundraising, well, I need to understand my personal temperament with the job and the duty that's being asked of me. What I've seen in my experiences, and I'm curious to hear yours, is how aware are employees or people that, you know, team members, how aware are they of their own temperament inside of the organizations that they work with? And do they put any credence to that? Or in other words, do they recognize how important their own makeup is to the organization that they're working for?
That's a good question. I think a lot of employees are struggling right now. So it's kind of hard for a lot of people because of all the stressors that are impacting the workforce figure it out how to respond to these issues. And also framing it as like how to be a good follower. I think a lot of people would have, many times they have a negative response to it because of the same thing that you said. They are more interested in leadership development. And I think particularly with Gen Zers who are really branching out to do their own thing and they are like quitting in unbelievable numbers right now. So I think, sometimes in my opinion, at least what I have found is that employees tend to be more comfortable following someone they really believe in, someone they can admire. If sometimes you have a leader who has those qualities, who is a great leader, and then people, it's very easy to follow that kind of leader. But a lot of leaders have a lot of issues that they need to work on too. So I think I don't think this problem is something that should be left only to employees or only to the leadership team. It's kind of a combined effort.
Absolutely, in which I'm in full agreement with the combination effort that you just mentioned. A lot of my work, I tell my patients that my job is to help them be a part of their own rescue. When I talk to individuals and we go over leadership, I tell them that they need to understand the leadership style that they are most responsive to and the leadership style that they aspire to have, and know that a style is a real thing. When I say it's a real thing, if I were to say autocratic versus transactional, those are actual styles. You'd have to understand those styles and say, I behave better here, or I perform better here, or I respond better here. Well, in that case, that has a lot to do with, one, we've talked about it before, but awareness. But number two is the ability to communicate that level of awareness, which I recognize even in today's climate, it may be difficult to have open dialogue about your style or about how you see the world. But simultaneously, it's important to have those conversations. One thing I want to belly back to is just the awareness for assistance. Black man, I know that in this country, we don't talk amongst one another about how we feel about things as a whole. And I'm using that as a stereotype, but it's generalized over my lifetime and all of the men that I know. And it's also not something where someone's ever said, you may want to talk to someone about that. Have you seen that same reality in just employees, other cultures? Just what is the general consensus when it comes to someone dealing with something psychological or mental, and then them seeking guidance for that? What does that look like on your end?
So you brought up a really important point, like in terms of minorities and then particularly men. and we had a discussion before about this. So it's kind of like how many black men, and even especially older black men, are significantly less likely to seek any kind of treatment. So historically, from my experiences, when I focus on that population, when they came to see me, it's usually because their wife told them, like, you go or I'm leaving you after 40 years, or the doctor has been telling them, you go or you're going to die. You need to manage the stress. So it's kind of extreme situations like that. And it's often difficult to start this conversation and engage people who feel there's a lot of stigma surrounding mental health and may not want to engage in these type of conversations. So what I do is I work with organizations to figure it out what would be the best approach. And I use so many different approaches that I customize to make sure that I'm addressing their needs. So as a starting point, I think it's helpful to do, it's effective to do events or retreats that cover everybody in the organization Because if you're covering everybody, you're not stigmatizing anyone specifically. You're actually making a statement as an organization saying, this is a problem that we are all struggling with, so let's work together to figure out how are we going to move forward. And what I do is I try to engage people with humor, with personal stories that they can relate to, all kind of different techniques. Sometimes I use graphics, or I may use video, or I may use conversations. I also talk directly to the issues that they are struggling with as an organization. So, for example, recently I talked to the Boys and Girls Club of America for all the employees on the wellness keynote. And that was, you know, besides engaging them and giving inspiration and motivation and all of that, I, you know, spoke about serious issues that they have been struggling with, like, which is providing services to marginalized children during the pandemic, which was extremely difficult. So doing a combination of things like that really works. So figuring out what is it that these, you know, what is this organization dealing with on a regular basis? What has been brought up by different employees, and what would be the most effective strategy for them?
So I would imagine, in whether it's a group session or maybe larger group, smaller group, however it is that it's sectioned out, that having a generalized conversation breaks the ice and removes the barrier of talking about things in a general way, but simultaneously those general issues affect people individually, which may open the door for them to then request private treatments where they can open up and really let you in on some of the things that's bothering them and allow you to make some really good breakthroughs. Has that been a part of your experience?
Absolutely, because when you present, I mean, I just love the idea of it coming in to, you know, going to organizations and presenting, because the response that I get from people is like, oh, I didn't know it was like this. You know, like they have an idea of what therapy is supposed to look like. And if you think about movies, you know, like if you close your eyes and you think like psychologist, like what comes to mind? It's usually like an older white man with glasses and is kind of like in silence most of the time. The person is doing all the talking. No one is laughing. Like he's crying. And yeah, so it's not like that for me, at least. I mean, I was trained in different approaches. I can use these long-term approaches and keep people for 20 years seeing me, but I don't think that's effective or ethical at this point, because we know right now that there are very effective treatments that can be implemented and you can see results in very short periods of time. I actually do, and one thing that people absolutely love and go crazy over is like I train people on using coping skills that cost you $0, like no money at all, or at the most $5 if you have to, and then almost no time, a few minutes of your time, very easy to remember and very effective. So I oftentimes have them practice them these skills during the session, during the keynote, and they see the results and they love it. And I do them as well in the first session when I meet with them. And that's what really gets them hooked on coming in again. But I never, from the beginning, I tell them, so it's very goal-oriented, short-term, and we are going to do, you know, it's intense type of treatment. So I'm going to give you everything that I believe will be effective to get you out of here and, you know, be able to function on your own. That's the goal.
I think that's fantastic. I'm going to pause here for a moment for a station break. Today's segment of Trending Thursdays is brought to you by Pro Elite Training. That is Pro Elite to one word. Pro Elite Training trains people and athletes to the metronome of music to increase rhythm, tempo, and pace. You can get it in your app store by just simply downloading Pro Elite Train or on web at getproelite.com. It is a freemium model, so you get hundreds of drills for free. Learn how to dribble a ball or do a back pedal or throw a three-punch combo through the metronome of music. Once again, that's Pro Elite Training, getproelite.com. So back to some of the things you were saying, Dr. Maria, is that you've got diversity in the strategies that you use, but there's never been a time, at least that, you know, my undergrad is in history, and there's a lot of history that I've studied, I've traveled the world studying history, And I just don't remember a time specifically that is as diverse as it is now. And when I say diverse, I'm not talking about just racial diversity, just diversity in thinking and just the freedom of thought that we've been able to express now. That directly states that how you go about treating people has to be diverse. What are some of the ways, and I don't need anything proprietary or secret in nature, but just some of the ways that when you look out into the world and you see that people are hurting or having a hard time at work or struggling in their careers, that how diverse is it? And then how are the ways that you're surprising them with treatment that allows them to see the world in a way that says, not only did I receive treatment once, but actually I want to make this a part of my health maintenance plan, if you will, a part of my self-love, a part of my self-awareness. What are some of the ways that you've been able to introduce that to people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. So I target different different issues. So one is I definitely cohort psychoeducation of all the types of activities that can help improve well-being, healthy eating, exercising. But not just, I mean, everybody knows that, yeah, I need to exercise. But I really like work with them to figure out what's the best strategy to actually make that happen, right? It's because knowing that something is good is not going to make you do it. So what is really going to increase your motivation and what type of strategy is going to work for you specifically? So it may not be signing up for a gym, every month. It's just not, you know, that might not work for you. But what might work for you might be Zumba classes at the park once a week or yoga or tennis, whatever. So I work with them on figuring out what is it that is going to work. I also connect with their medical providers. So one of the first questions I ask is like, when was the last time you went to your physician? And if they say anything other than, you know, less than a year, I send them to the physician. I help them identify one to make sure that there's not a medical issue interfering with their performance and their mental health. And then the other thing that people absolutely love this, and most people never think about this, is and they actually love when I say it. It's like, I want us to find activities that are therapeutic, but they are not traditional therapy. And people smile every time because it's like, yes, you know, I want to do, because most people want to feel empowered and independent. They want to be able to, you know, live without therapy. And so some of these things can be surprising for people. But these activities include connection with art. And a lot of people know about art therapy. So creating art, it has been shown to be therapeutic for many years. What most recently has been found that even art viewing, so she's going to a museum, going to an art exhibit, going to an art fair, can significantly reduce your stress levels. So I serve on the board of the Contemporary Arts Center and the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. And oftentimes people think, what are you doing there? Like, what's the connection? And it's actually a very strong connection. And research has shown this. So for instance, one study conducted by the Cleveland Clinic found that just after viewing pieces in the hospital's contemporary art collection, more than 60% of patients reported a decrease in stress. And the World Health Organization has recognized this, has done, you know, research over 19 years span. And they show that art has positive overall effects for mental and physical health. Music listening can have a positive effect on both psychological stress experiences, so like reducing restlessness, reducing anxiety, and physiological arousal, so heart rate, blood pressure, hormonal levels. So these are pretty easy things to do because people may be like, oh, I don't feel like going to the gym, but I can listen to music, right? Or I can like view art. So those are pretty passive experiences. They don't require a lot of effort on your part. So you can start with those if you don't feel like going to the gym at the beginning.
Well, you talk about some things that I think my listeners really need to pick up on, and I'm going to repeat them and state them a little differently to make sure that it's not lost on them. And that one, you know, it is proven, it couldn't be more science, that working out and, you know, physical health and wellness is a benefit to relieving stress. However, you and I both know this, and I think the world knows it, is that working out itself can be stressful for people. So trying to figure out when am I going to work out? I actually don't like working out. Working out hurts and it's problematic. So it's not about getting on the treadmill and trying to find a way to mentally do 20 miles on the treadmill, but it's more about finding things that allows your body to move, release, you know, those endorphins that allow you to feel better about yourself. And there are, and if you're a small business owner out there today, maybe you have a training company, I'm going to give this one to you for free, is that maybe it's not about transforming the body at all. It's creating community around events that people like to do, feel good about that community while they're moving their body, which allows them to get the benefits of health and wellness. Another point is I ran into a young entrepreneur that is now making coloring books for adults. And so, you know, these coloring books, they can subscribe to the portfolio of them. And instead of it being, you know, you're drawing something of Frozen like my 8-year-old daughter would do, this is more about drawing, you know, characters that you would watch as an adult. Maybe it's anime, maybe it's a mini series. But now these things that you're coloring gives you a pastime that you can feel good about, even if you're not an artist, but you still like the color. And so in these instances, these are different ways of engaging in the ways of health and wellness, reducing stress, feeling good about yourself or your environment or your time and space, but doing it in a way that's comfortable, that feels good to you, and something that you would look forward to doing, as opposed to saying, oh, here's another thing that I have to do because I'm not feeling so good in this way. And that's what you mean by having different types of strategies. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So make it fun. So it could be, you know, golf outings is one that men are more likely to sign for. That's great. You know, you get sun, you get to hang out with your buddies, you move your body. So that's great. You know, just figure out dancing or going, seeing jazz, like a jazz concert. So lately I've been going to a lot of concerts, like tiny ones, bigger ones, whatever. But it's just so nice to connect with people, meet people from the community, be outside. So the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra now is the one that was for Juneteenth celebration this past Sunday. And it was amazing. And we were all outside. It was completely free. And it was a great way to connect with everybody. And they will have every Sunday more free concerts like that. And Cincinnati is great. A lot of people ask me, like, what are you doing in Cincinnati still? You know, like, you lived in Florida before, Boston. Like, what are you still doing there? And I say, I actually found a lot of things that I love here. I really love and enjoy. One of those is definitely my connection to the arts. There's a lot happening in the art world. This weekend alone, like I think they have the Final Friday at Pendleton, Final Friday at Cincinnati Art Museum, the SOS Art, which is focused on social justice issues. I mean, incredible. Three things happening this Friday. Like, you have to go. Like, at least try it, you know. It's just viewing art. You don't even have to create anything. So, but it can really enhance your life. It can improve your overall mood. It can help you connect with other people. It gets you out of the house. And most of these things are, so these three things that I mentioned, completely free.
Well, I think in this instance, what you're talking about, or the way that I'm receiving it, and I'm going to put it out to the listener base, is that it's your perception of life in reality, and then how do you shift it based on things that you place value on. So, you know, and it's no different than me. I'm a transplant to Cincinnati. I'm originally from Detroit. And many people, especially within my network, think that I should probably be in a place like Atlanta or Charlotte based on the work that I do and the connectivity that I have. But I tell them that there's things that I've built in Cincinnati that I look forward to that make me feel good about my existence. But it's really a perception change, because I can easily say there's nothing here in Cincinnati for me and make a decision to go elsewhere looking for something else. I think when you're in the workspace, it's when you take a position, you have to really understand what you're taking the position for, how you fit in that position, and what that community has to offer in that position. I'll give an example to qualify my statement, is that one of the reasons why I have a PhD in leadership and in business isn't because I was attracted to the position. Everything that I had ever done in my life, I ended up leading it. So if I went to a random recreation center to play basketball, they would ask me to pick the teams. If I was in class, I'd be the person leading the class project. So because that was my reality, I decided to credentialize around that. But here's my point of saying it, is that when I go into, when I worked in corporate, I had to be conscious of, well, you're an employee here. You're not the person making the decisions. So you have to be smart about, if I don't like a decision, am I okay with living with the decision? If I don't like a format, if I don't understand a process, can I still operate even though I don't understand why they implemented this process? And I personally believe there may be a better way. That's a conversation I would have to have with myself to make sure that the perception of my existence within a place is a benefit. Therefore, I don't have to receive that new process as frustration or stress to me. I can say I can accomplish what it is that I'm responsible or obligated to take care of while understanding that whatever it is that I'm doing is getting me closer to my goal. If I interpret that to what you just mentioned, is that, well, if you're in a place and you're trying to figure out how do I deal with the stress, how do I uplift my mood and make my mood better, well, you look for things that would essentially be your tribe. You would do things that would fit inside of your world that then makes you feel good about the things you're doing. But even that takes an exercise to do. Am I right in saying that as it relates to how people see the world?
Absolutely, yeah. Perception is everything. You know, and yeah, so you brought up great points, and I was talking to a real estate company that time for a wellness retreat, but, you know, oftentimes people say, like, oh, you know, like, if I lived in Florida, I would go to the beach every day. And I asked them, like, do you go to the parks here? And usually the response is not. And Cincinnati has unbelievable parks. I post, I've been posting recently about different sunrises. So I've been going to different parks and just enjoying the sunrise. It's just, it improves your mood in a way that, oh my God, it's like incredible. And it's completely natural. You know, like it really costs you, again, $0. It's just driving 10 minutes oftentimes, if that. And enjoying something that is you know, it's a gift.
So what I hear in your statement is that you're also talking about how to balance your life. So therefore, the balance takes over and minimizes stress. If you don't mind, touch on how a person can do that in either the workplace for themselves or how an appointed leader can then create that atmosphere for their employees to increase job satisfaction.
Yeah. So in terms of organizations, I think assessment first, so starting with assessing what the situation is, get an understanding of specifics of what their employees go through, because like I mentioned, depending on which industry you're in, the concerns that people have are very different. So the presentation should be customized to, you know, to address those things. And then when you have an understanding of that, doing general presentations, like I mentioned, is helpful to help lower the stigma. Then a very effective way to deal with mental health issues and individual interventions is the EAP program, the Employee Assistance Program. So, and this is another issue that I think is important to mention, the return on investment, because, and this is a connection that people don't make generally. 3 years ago, the CEO of the Linder Center of Hope released a white paper called "When Mental Health Care is Worth Paying For," and the return on investment for successfully treated mental illness beat Wall Street. And never has this been more true than it is today. So at the time, he used a landmark study that showed that for every dollar that gets invested in treating mental illness, you can get a return of $37. And that study included severe mental illness, so the return for
I'm gonna pause you there because I think that's worth us repeating, saying, and listening to. You put a buck in, you get a $37 back based on the research. Whether that's showing up in productivity, whether it's showing up in efficiency, whether that's showing up in the lack of employee turnover, but there's a $37 ratio return based on your investment in the mental health. Did I hear you correctly?
Yes. Yeah. So this is based on a landmark study done in 2008. That study, so the caveat to that is that included severe mental illness. So the return for those cases is higher. Now, newer studies that included cases of burnout, you know, work-related stress, you know, like lower levels. They showed lower return investment, but it's still positive, and it's still beating Wall Street. So as an example, a recent study shows that small business owners can expect to get $3 for every dollar they invest on the employee assistance program. So the reason for this is because mental health care has been shown to, like you said, increasing productivity, customer loyalty, employee engagement, and has also been shown to reduce turnover, which is something that every employer is concerned about, and disability claims. So for those who say, I cannot afford mental health care, I'm here to tell you, you cannot afford not to have it.
Well, I would even say it a little differently, although I'm in full agreement with you, is that it's not even about whether you can afford it or not. That's almost like saying, I can't afford to give you $5 and you turn around and give me $25. Well, that statement doesn't make any sense anymore. That would be a no-brainer investment that you would have to make. But it's really obvious if you take the time to think about it. I speak on a concept regularly in which I even put it in one of my books called How to Make Good Business Decisions. But metacognition is the science of thinking about what you think about. And as you're thinking about things, you would say, all right, if my people feel better about where they are, they feel connected to the mission, they've been heard, and we program around them to make sure that they're the best version of them that they can be at all times, it's only obvious that they would produce higher, that they would not leave, they'd be more loyal to the operation, and you'd have better cohesiveness inside of the organization. I don't see why that wouldn't be an obvious reality or conclusion that an appointed leader would come to, but it seems as if it would just smack them in the face that that should be the reality. I think what's awesome is that there's even numbers, facts, statistics, data that's pushing that. So with that being the case, and I'm looking for an opinion from your experience, what typically is the pushback outside of dollars? Is it, we don't have enough time, we don't have the right structure, we don't know who would actually do it? Do you see other reasons as to why appointed leaders don't spend the time in this space?
Yeah, sometimes time is brought up as an issue, or just still having a stigma around mental health, not knowing how to go about it. So one thing that I recommend, especially in the when you start addressing this, to stay away from even saying mental health, like just more, you know, focusing on wellness or burnout, because people tend to be more open to discuss that. And then you can extend the conversation to include mental health issues. And I think a really important piece of this is to, you know, get the right people. Because that is a huge thing, you know, like they might be hiring someone who has no training in mental health. And you started this program by saying, you know, you're not going to, you know, you can't hire someone to give you legal advice if they're not a lawyer. You need to hire the right people to help you on this. And this is the same way. So I see a lot of people. So I like the fact that people are engaged in the conversation from all different backgrounds, and they want to help and they want to participate. I'm all for that. But at the very least, have an advisor who is a licensed mental health professional. So either a person who is advising you on that or is leading the program. But you should not leave this to someone who is not trained or licensed.
Where did the negative connotation come from regarding mental health? Just based on your experiences, you know, it looks like it's a taboo word. People don't want to touch it. But I wonder why that's the case. Any idea at all?
For the stigma surrounding mental health?
Correct. You know, as to why we just, you know, we can call it, you know, well-being. But with the moment you start talking mental health, it appears as if no one wants to discuss it. I wonder, how did that develop and get to that point?
I think, I mean, it's a long history, but at some point, you know, people with mental illness would get, like, locked in hospitals for very long times, or even, like, you know, beaten or tortured, like, I mean, long time ago. But it's still, you know, I think that you know, it's because people naturally, all humans, we have a tendency, and we're wired to do this. to kind of like respond negatively when we see someone behaving in a way that we don't believe is normal or acceptable, right? So it's a natural reaction, or the same if we see someone with a severe disease. It's kind of like it's a natural reaction. It's for survival mainly, like to stay away from someone who might be a threat. So I think recognizing that, so going back to self-awareness, in recognizing that we all have biases, and that if someone is acting out in a way that is unexpected, it may be scary or difficult or uncomfortable, but it's important to, you know, take a deep breath and have a lot of compassion, because generally people with mental health issues generally are not violent. Most people who have mental health, and this has been a big misconception that has been created, but the truth is that most people with mental health issues will not be violent against others. They are more likely to be victims of violence than offenders.
Mm. Well, I would also add in there, I mean, don't they suffer from more isolation and other ailments that come along that prohibit them from being good in the workplace or force them to transition and leave altogether? Are those things that turn into symptoms as well?
Yeah, so I actually just published a book chapter on the cycle, the connection between poverty and mental illness, and how one fits the other. So if you start, especially for people of color, for children of color, this has been the case for a very long time, unfortunately. But what has happened over time is that children of color, when they behave improperly in a school, they are being, you know, stigmatized as like they're bad kids, you know, they should be expelled or suspended. And if it's a white student, usually he, you know, or she like gets like, oh, okay, it's a mental health issue going on, let's figure it out, the treatment. And for other issues, the minority communities have been very outspoken for other concerns like housing, education, and things. But with mental health, they stay quiet for a long time because of a stigma. So even though it didn't feel good to see how kids were being, you know, treated as like misbehaving, it almost felt worse for some people to say, oh, he has a mental health issue. So it was almost, you know, for some people, the preference was like, well, okay, he was misbehaving.
Mm-hmm. Because so I guess misbehaving gives you a level of control toward it, and I'm speculating here, I have no idea, but that you can then behave when you choose to behave, and you misbehave because it was something under your realm. But if it was mental health and you can't control it, that means that you're less than or less valuable, and we can't really work with you.
Right, and that's a huge, that's a huge misconception too, because mental health issues are very treatable. So we have very effective treatments, and it is extremely important that we identify these issues early on, ideally in childhood, adolescence, because they're very common, especially now, and provide the kids with the treatment they need, and because then you can stop the cycle from starting. So what I was mentioning regarding the book chapter is like you have a child who got identified early on as, you know, having conduct problems, and then he got suspended, failed, and ended up in the juvenile detention and met other, you know, troubled children, and then he got into more trouble and then used substances to deal with it, and then he ended up unemployed and homeless and like poor, and once he's in poverty, he cannot access mental health treatment. So it's almost like, when the cycle starts, it's almost unstoppable. It's extremely hard to get out of it.
Well, I think one thing that I can see is if we're talking about that within the student population, those realities exist amongst the working class. And in the working class, your services are less. See, at least if you're in the school system, you're going to have educators there. You're going to have some level of programming that will then attach to the student. But as a worker in the workplace, unless the employer or the appointed leader sees a need for that service inside the company or the organization, you won't get it. And in that instance, you're left to your own awareness, your own devices and resources to say, how do I deal with the problem that I'm dealing with? And because of perceptual things that we talked about before, your issue may not even be your job, but it might feel like it's your job based on the things you're seeing, but really they stem from something else. And because it's never been treated, you don't know how to separate either what you're seeing, what you're experiencing. So sometimes those experiences could be real. Sometimes they may not be. But in the instance, you don't have a legitimate outlet to even help you process any of it. Is that a reality?
Absolutely. So that is a great comparison. So in the same way that schools are, you know, providing, unfortunately, not all of them, but, you know, some of them are starting to take this more seriously and providing trainings or social emotional trainings for children, for every child. And then individual therapy for children who need more attention. The same thing should be done by employees. Same thing.
Absolutely. Well, in the shortness of our time, Doctor, thank you so much. How can our audience find a way to get in contact with you, whether they have questions, whether they need services? How can they reach you?
Yeah, so I'm very easy to find because I'm all over social media. So if you Google me and you put Dr. Maria Espinola, you'll see a lot of different things, including the main website. So it's drmariaespinola.com. I'm on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, everywhere. Also, if you, let me see. So when let me give you a number too. So the number now is 513-717-5591. So that's another one. So if they want to reach me directly, but again, 513-717-5591, and then online.
Fantastic. And spell Espinola for them again to make sure that they find you appropriately.
What?
Well, I was asking to spell your last name again so that way they know exactly how to find you.
Yeah, so Espinola is Espinola.
So that's it, everyone. Thank you so much, Dr. Maria, for coming on the show and talking about something that is definitely trending, just not really here in the United States, but globally. It's something that we have to pay attention to. You know, we've had instances now that have been very highly commercialized, which, you know, whether we're talking about in the athletic world where athletes are saying, hey, I need to pay attention to my mental health, all the way to large CEOs of major corporations that are speaking about it now. Please pay attention to it in your own company, in your own organization, just for your own wellness and for the wellness of the employees that that work for you. As a micro boutique or small business owner, it is important to stay aware of your feelings, how you view your world, the stress levels that you're underneath, because there's so many obligations that a small business owner has to endure that alone can keep you from being successful. And remember, you don't create the business in order to become a slave to the business. You create the business because you have something to offer to this world, and it is your selected and chosen method to take care of yourself and or your family, not for you to become a slave to the actual industry or job itself. Thank you, everybody, and I look forward to seeing everybody tomorrow on Financial Friday. I am Dr. Baker, and this is Doctor's Orders.
Thank you for joining us for Doctor's Orders. You can contact Dr. Baker by phone at 1-855-249-4677, by email at info@drbaker.us. You can learn more on our website at www.drbaker.us. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. right here on 1320 AM, 103.9 FM, and on www.1320thevoice.com.